Organize our topics and Purim.
Thank you, Rabbi Shabtai. Last week we discussed the status of the Gerim of Shushan, and I thought today we continue on the theme of discussing other Megillas Esther related Yuchsin matters. The first topic is that of the status of converts from Amalek, and in fact, Haman's own personal status. There's a fascinating sefer written a few decades ago by a Rabbi Yerachmiel Seltzer, don't know who he was, but he wrote a sefer entitled Ner Lemea, which includes 100 chapters on the topic of the conversion, permissibility of converting Amalekites, and the personal status of Haman. So what we'll discuss today partially works off some of the topics that he raises in that sefer. There's a Mechilta, Mechilta de Rashbi, Parshas Beshalach, that writes as follows. Vayomer ki yad al kes ka milchama l'sham ba'amalek v'dor dor. Rabbi Yeshua omer, l'kashiyeshev HaKadosh Baruch Hu al kisei malchusa tehei mamlachta ba'osa sham milchama l'sham ba'amalek. At the time that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will sit on his throne, there will be a battle against Amalek. I'm skipping a couple lines. Then it says, Reb Lazar Omer, Nishba HaMakom B'Kisei Kavod Shelo, Kadosh Baruch Hu Kaviyachol took a shvua on the Kisei HaKavod, Shem Yavo Mikol HaUmos Sheikabluhu, that if a interested ger should come from any nation of the world, he will accept him. They should accept him. Umei Amalek, Ulubeso lo yikabluhu. But should a prospective ger come from a Amalek or his household, we may not accept such a ger. Shenamar, Vayomer David alanar hamagidlo emizaata, Vayomer ben ish ger Amaleki anochi. The psalm in the beginning of Shmuel Beis tells us about the immediate aftermath of Shaul Hamelech's death, where a lad approaches David HaMelech and tells him about how he was involved in killing or allowing Shaul to kill himself. Questionable exactly what happened there. And David asks this lad, to identify himself. And he says that he is the son of a Ger Amaleki, the son of an Amaleki convert. Nisgar leDavid v'osa shah mashenemer leMoshe Rabbeinu. At that moment, David HaMelech recalled that which was said to Moshe Rabbeinu. Im yavo mikol ha'umos sheba'olam lisgayir sheikabluhu. If anyone comes from any of the nations of the world to convert, we accept them. Umibeso shelo yikabluhu. But from the house of Amalek, we will not accept a convert. Miyad, immediately, vayomer elav David, damcha al roshecha, kificha anabacha. And at that moment, David said, you're responsible for your own life, for your own blood, because you did yourself in. Meaning to say that this Ger Amaleki was liable to be killed because he was an Amaleki. And apparently, as the Mechilta understands, the conversion of Amaleki not only is not permissible, but doesn't remove the prohibition of Mechias Amalek. And that's why David killed this Nar Amaleki. Some are bothered. How does this fit with the Gemara that we're probably familiar with in Sanhedrin, Tzadivav Amabez? The Gemara tells us, Mibnei Banav Shel Haman Lamdu Torah B'Bnei Brak. That Haman's descendants learned Torah in B'Nei Brak. So it sounds like Haman had descendants that were Megayir. If it's in fact the case that we may not accept Amaleki converts, then how did Haman's descendants convert? Now, there is an alternate girsa in that Gemara that Rabbi Kasher quotes in his Torah Shleim. Instead of Mibnei Banav Shel Haman, the descendants of Haman, there's a variant text that says Mibnei Banav Shel Naaman, the descendants of Naaman, many generations earlier, not of Haman, and that would solve the problem. But if we have the Gemara the way it appears in front of us, Mibnei Banav Shel Haman, it sounds like we do accept converts from the progeny of Amalek. The Chazon Ish addresses this question. Chazon Ish, Evan Ezer, Simon Kuf Mem Vav, Evan Ezer, Kuf Mem Vav. Chazon Ish suggests one of two possibilities. Either that Haman's descendants, we're talking many generations later potentially, Haman's descendants got mixed together with others, and it wasn't clear exactly who was who, and at that point they were accepted into the Jewish people. Or perhaps the prohibition against converting Amalekim only applies during a time of war and not other times during history. Rav Avadia Yosef, in his Chazon Avadia on Purim, has another suggestion that maybe the descendants of Haman that we're talking about were Amalekim on the maternal line. They were descended from Haman on the maternal line, but not on the paternal line. And when it comes to the nations of the world, as opposed to the Jewish people, Yichus is defined based on the father, not based on the mother. So if, in fact, these were maternal descendants of Haman, but not on the father's side, then they would not have the halachic status of Amalekim, and therefore there would be no impediment against converting them. However, it's questionable whether this mechilta is actually universally accepted to begin with. In this Sefer Ner Lemeya, he points out that there are a couple Rambams that seem to indicate the Rambam did not accept this mechilta, and that the Rambam has no prohibition against converting Amalekim. The first Rambam is in Isurei Bia, Perek Yud Beis, Halacha Yud Zayin. Perek Yud Beis, Halacha Yud Zayin. So here the Rambam talks about those nations where there are restrictions on the marriageability of converts from those nations into the Jewish people. So the Rambam writes in Halacha Yud Zayin, Kol Ha'akum Kulam Kisha Yisgayru V'yakabalu Olein Kol HaMitzvot Shebatorah. Any non-Jew that converts, or when they convert, and they accept upon themselves all the mitzvot of the Torah, V'avadim Kisha Yishtacharu, and similarly an Eved Kanani when he becomes freed, they have a full status of a 100% Jew. Chutz midalat amim dilvad, except for four nations, behem amon umoav mitzrayim ve'edom. And that's what the Rambam goes on to explain, that a ger from amon umoav can never marry into the Jewish people. A ger from Mitzrayim and Edom cannot marry in for the first three generations. However, no evidence in the Rambam of any further restriction upon other nations of the world to convert. And it does not sound like the Rambam had any such restriction on an Amaleki convert. Moreover, the Rambam in Perek Yud Ches Sanhedrin Halacha Vav, at the very conclusion of Hilchos Sanhedrin, quotes the story of David and the Ger Amaleki in a very different context. The Rambam writes, Gzeiras HaKosefi, She'ei Mamisin Bezdin V'lo Malkin Es Adam V'hodas Piv, Ela Al Pishnei Edim. There's a Gzeiras HaKosef, there's a Torah law that you're not allowed, Bezdin is not allowed to murder someone or give them malchus to punish someone, either with misa or malchus, based on that person's self-incrimination. You can only punish someone with misa or malchus if you have the testimony of two witnesses that testify to the act that this person committed. Then the Rambam is bothered by a problem. If that's the case, there seem to be other examples in Tanakh where people were punished without that kind of due process. Zesha harag Yeshua Achan. How is it that Yeshua was able to kill Achan after Achan took the spoils of Yericho? The David leger Amaleki. And how was David able to kill the ger Amaleki Bodas PM based on their own self-representation, their own self-incrimination? Haras Shah Haisa. So either that was a one-time dispensation, or Yeshua and David HaMelech had the halacha of a king, and a king has certain licenses to punish people in an extra-legal fashion. Amala Sanhedrin, Ein Mamisin V'lo Malkin Amod B'Aveira, Shema Nitra Fadaito B'Davrizet. etc. However, Sanhedrin, under normal circumstances, had no license to kill someone based on their own self-incrimination. So the Rambam here has a very different perspective on the episode of David and the Gera Maleki. No evidence that the Gera Maleki was killed because he was an Amaleki. It sounds like he was killed because he killed Shaul HaMelech. And even though there was no testimony to that effect, under these circumstances, he was allowed to be killed by David HaMelech because either it was a one-time exception or a Rav Shah, or David HaMelech had a din of a Melech and was able to engage in extra legal punishment. Okay. The Sefer Emek Bracha by Rav Arya Pomeranchik, one of the Talmidim of the Brisker Rav, who moved to Eretz Yisrael, I believe in the late 1920s, early 1930s, and passed away at a very young age. But he wrote two beautiful svarim. One of them is the Emek Bracha, which has essays, brief essays on various Orach Chaim related topics. So he has a brief piece on the Mitzvah of Mechias HaMalek, in which he writes that the reason you're not allowed to accept converts from a Malek is because that would lead to not fulfilling the mitzvah of Mechias HaMalek. That if you have an Amaleki, there's a mitzvah to destroy him. If you convert him, then you're being mevatel, you're avoiding that mitzvah to destroy him. But if you were to convert an Amaleki in violation of this Mechilta, if you assume that the Mechilta is normative, that Geirus would still be a valid Geirus. The person would be a bona fide convert, even if he shouldn't have been converted to begin with. And in the analysis of the Emek Bracha, the reason that David didn't believe in the Gera Maleki was because he didn't believe that a Beis Din would have converted him. If had a Beis Din converted him, it would have been an acceptable Geirus. The Geirus would be valid, but David HaMelech didn't believe that a Beis Din would have converted this Ger Amaleki. Klei Chemda, in Parshas Shoftim, Klei Chemda writes that if you convert a Ger Amaleki, then as any convert, they have the status of Ger Shenis Gayer Kikatan Shenola Dami. That if a person converts, they have the status of a newborn baby. Any previous relationships, familial relationships, are no longer in place. So as a matter of in principle Torah law, if you have two, a brother and a sister convert together, in principle, they have no familial relationship and they could even marry each other. Not allowed to do that in practice because of a notion, Shelo Yomru, people shouldn't say that these people converted to have it easier, to go from a Kedusha a Chamura to Kedusha Kala, to go from a more stringent status to a more lenient status. But in principle, Gershon Eskai Kikotan Shinola Dami means that any previous relationship no longer exists, any Yichus doesn't exist after conversion. So the Klei Chemda writes, Meir Don Plotsky, he writes that if you have a Ger Amaleki, then after he converts, he's no longer considered to be from the progeny of Amalek. And therefore, there would be no further mitzvah of Mechias Amalek on this Ger Amaleki, would not have that status anymore. And then he notes that Haman, in fact, was an Eved Kanani of Mordechai. And that's what's evidenced in the Gemara in Megillah on Daf Tesvav Amud Aleph, that Haman was an Eved Kanani. He was a servant to Haman. The Gemara there has a very brief line, but it's explicated in the Midrashim. The Gemara on the bottom of Tesvav and Menalef and Megillah just writes as follows. V'cholze inenu shoveli. Haman says about Mordechai that all the wonderful things going on in my life are of no significance so long as I see Mordechai around. Amar Blazer, Amar B'chanina, B'shah Shara Hamanus Mordechai, Yoshe B'shar Melech. At the time that Haman saw Mordechai sitting in the gate of the palace, Amar Kol Zeh Inenu Shaveli, is of no worth to me. Kedrev Chista, the Amar of Chista, Zeh Ba Bipruz Buli, Vizeba biprus buti. This one came with prusbuli. This one came with prusbuti. What does that mean? The Rashi writes, ba biprusbuli, Mordechai ba elav betanos osher. That Mordechai was coming from a claim, a place of wealth. Haman ba betanos oni. And Haman was coming from a place of poverty. Shemachar Haman es atzmo lemordechai kodem lechen yamim rabin. Because Haman had sold himself previously to Mordechai, the kikare lechem, for loaves of bread. So what is this reference here to Haman's sale of himself to Mordechai? So there are two versions of this in Medrash that discuss this episode of Haman and Mordechai. Version number one, in the Yalkut Shimoni, Tuf Tuf Nun Vav, the Yalkut says that Pam Achas Nasan HaMelech Maman, once upon a time, the king dispersed money to Mordechai and Haman. V'shigram b'rashe gaisos lichboshes ha-medina. And they were dispersed to, or they were appointed to head army legions in order to conquer some territory. So Mordechai and Haman were leading two divisions of the king's army. Natal Haman Maman Shalov Achlo. So Haman took the money he was given, and he literally ate it up. He squandered it. V'lo nishtayr lo Maman, and he had no money left. Kishaba lahutzi al bale milchama lo haya biyado klum. So when he needed the funds to pay for the soldiers, he had nothing left. Aval Mordechai chatzi shel Maman haya biyado, but Mordechai still had half of the funds that the king had given him. So Haman came to Mordechai. Amarlo, halveni Maman zeh shebiyadcha. He said, lend me the money that you have. Amarlo, so Mordechai said to Haman, ein ani melavcha el imkein timkor nafshecha leavidly. I'm only going to give you the money as a loan if you sell yourself to me as a servant. Kibal al nafsho, so Haman accepted the deal. He had no choice. The helveyu, he lent him, Mordechai lent Haman the money. The Kasavlo, and he wrote a shtar, wrote a document indicating that Haman was now sold to Mordechai as his servant. Zavanafshe le Mordechai betulma denama. So he sold his soul to Mordechai for a loaf of bread. That's the version that appears in Yalkut Shimoni. Otzer HaMidrashim has a little bit of a different version. The story that's outlined over there is that at the time that Mordechai was exiled from Yerushalayim with the Golus of Yechonya, as referenced in Megillas Esther. So he was traveling to Golus, and Haman was there as well. And Haman was starving on the way. He asked Mordechai to give him some bread. He gave him some bread. The next day, Haman wanted bread again. So at that point, Mordechai says to him, I'm not mechuyev to give you bread at my expense. If I give you all my food, then I'm going to die. So Haman says to Mordechai, knei gufi, acquire my body. I'll become your eved. So Mordechai says, eknes yadecha b'kikar lechem, I will acquire you with a loaf of bread. So Mordechai says to him, Echtov al raglecha shtar b'ksovis kaka, let me write the document of sale on your leg in some tattoo. I'm going to engrave it on your leg. So Haman says, fine. So he engraved on his leg, Haman ben Amadasa eved l'Mordechai. And that's why Haman was so jealous of Mordechai later on, which led to the episodes in the Megillah. So that's what the Gemara Megillah briefly references, and it's explained at greater length in these two versions of the Medrash, that whatever the context was, and at some point earlier, Haman had been sold to Mordechai as an Ebed. It says the Klei Chemda, if Mordechai acquired Haman as an Ebed, then presumably he acquired him as a halachic Ebed, that for a Jew to acquire a non-Jewish Ebed, he has the status of an Ebed Kanani. Ebed Kanani means that you give the Eved Mila, you take the Eved to a mikvah, like the Geirus process. And the Neve Kanani is obligated in mitzvahs like a woman. He's mechuyib in mitzvahs keisha. So whatever mitzvahs a woman is obligated in, an Eved Kanani is obligated in as well. So then it seems to follow from this that Haman had a status of an Eved Kanani. An Eved Kanani is a partial Jew, and he's mechuyib in mitzvahs keisha. So the Klechanda points out that there's another mechilta. Mechilta has a machlokas whether the mitzvah of destroying Amalek only applies to the men of Amalek, or does it apply to the animals as well? Now, we all know the Haftorah last week's Sedra, that Shaul HaMelech was faulted strongly for not killing the animals of Agag of Amalek. But what seems to emerge from this Mechilta is that, according to one opinion, that wasn't the Torah requirement of Mechias Amalek. That was a Rosh Hashanah. That was a one-time directive that Shaul HaMelech had to kill the Tzon as well. But the actual Torah mitzvah of Mechias Amalek only applies to people and not to the animals. So that's a machlokes in the Mechilta. Does it apply to the animals? Does it apply to the people as well? So says the Klechanda, if it's the case that it only applies to people, then it could be an Eved Kanani is an Eved Kanani may have the status of an animal as far as this is concerned, and not of a full Amaleki. So maybe the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek would not have applied to Haman once he became an Eved Kanani. An Eved Kanani that has the partial status of a Jew. And more than that, it's very possible, the Klechanda develops further, that Mordechai at some point freed Haman as his Eved Kanani. So once he freed Eved Kanani, so then they become a full Jew. You're Meshachar and Eved Kanani, the Machlokas, so whether you have to take it to the mikveh again, but if you free an Eved Kanani, that person becomes a full Jew. Now, in the Sefer Ner Lameya, he points out that the din is you're not allowed to be Meshachar and Eved Kanani for no reason. Olam behem tavodu. So maybe Haman ran away, and if an Eved runs away, and the Baalim are Nisyayish, they give up hope of retrieving the Eved, so then they're Yosei L'Cheres anyway, then they gain their freedom, and then that Eved Kanani would default into a full Jew. According to that, Haman was Jewish. Says the Ner Lameya, he points out a statement of the Chasam Sofer. I couldn't find the Chasam Sofer inside. He says it's in the Torah Moshe, the Chasam Sofer Svarim on Chumash. So if you find it, please let me know. But he quotes in the Chasam Sofer that pshat when in the Megillah, and it says that Vayhi Kamram Elav Yom Yom Loshem Alehem, that when Haman was talking every day, and Mordechai didn't listen to bow down. Vayikam Amram Elav Yom Vayom Lo Shem Alehem Vayagidu LaHaman L'Ros Hayamdu Divrei Mordechai. So they told Haman to see what's going to be with Mordechai's words. Ki Gid Lahem Asher Yehudi, because Mordechai told them that he's Jewish. So everyone wanted to tell Haman that Mordechai is not bowing down. Says the Chasam Sofer, according to this citation, no, the antecedent is wrong. Ki Gid Lahem Asher Hu Yehudi is that he told them that he's Jewish, that Haman's Jewish, that everyone is coming to see what's going to happen with Mordechai and Haman, because they realized that Haman himself was also Jewish. So is he going to make a big deal about the fact that Mordechai's not bound to him because Mordechai's Jewish? Haman's also Jewish, because Haman was this Eved Kanani that was freed. So Mordechai said, yeah, Haman's also Jewish. What do you want from me? And he says in the Sefer Ner Lameya, maybe that's also pshat in another statement of the Gemara. The Gemara says, different versions in Chazal, how many sons did Haman have? So the Gemara says, Haman had 30 sons. 10 of them were killed. 10 of them were hung. And 10 of them were chozer malapsachim. 10 of them were poor and begged for their livelihood after the end of the Purim episode. So if it's true that there was a mitzvah of Bechias Amalek, and the Jews under Mordechai's leadership were trying to eliminate all the Amalekim, so how do they let these other 10 sons of Haman run around being Chozer al Pesachim? They should have killed them. Suggests the Ner Lemeya, maybe these sons were born after Haman was an Eved Meshucher, after he was freed from being an Eved Kanani, at which point he had the status of a Jew, and then the sons that he bore afterwards would not be considered Amalekim. They were sons of a Jewish father. Furthermore, Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, Yaros Devash, Chelek Aleph, Drush Yid Zayin, suggests that this new understanding about Haman status may explain another problem. How is it that Esther invited Haman and Mordechai to her Seuda on Pesach? Right, if you count the days, the second Seuda of Achashverosh and Haman with Esther was on Tesvav Nisan. The din is, you're not allowed to invite a non-Jew to a meal on Yontif because you're worried you may end up cooking extra for the non-Jew. And the heter, the dispensation to cook on Yontif, does not apply to food given to non-Jews. So says Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz that, no, if Haman was Mordechai's Eved Kanani, so that's a different status, because you are allowed to perform malacha on Yontif on behalf of an Eved Kanani. And once you're allowed to invite Haman as an Eved Kanani, then Esther could have invited Achashverosh as well to the same Seuda. And one final halacha that becomes clearer with this understanding that Haman was an Eved Kanani is a comment that the Mishnah Berurah quotes in Siman Tuf Reish Pei Tesef Katan Beis, Tuf Reish Pei Tesef Katan Beis. He quotes the Machlokas whether an Eved Kanani is Mechuyev in Megillah. We know that women are Chayavas in Megillah. Is an Eved Kanani Chayav in Megillah? So he explains the Mishnah Berurah that if you say an Eved Kanani is Pater from Megillah, that's because the only reason that women are included in Mrs. Megillah is because As Hein Hayaboso and Ace. They were also part of the miracle. They face the same threat of annihilation as every other Jew, and therefore women are Mechuyavos in Mikra Megillah. So says the Sefer, actually, I don't remember if this is in the Ner Lemeya or someone else points this out, that maybe, how do you know if this is the case, that women are mechuyavos because afeinu yibosaneis, they face the same threat of annihilation. But maybe the avadim kananim also face the same threat of annihilation. Ella what? That no, Haman did not extend the edict of annihilating all the Jews to avadim kananim, because Haman himself was an Eved Kanani, so he couldn't have proclaimed that they would kill all the avadim kananim, because he was an Eved Kanani himself. So these are various potential ramifications of Haman's status as an Eved Kanani, or perhaps even an Eved Meshuchrar who was Jewish. And if that's the case, then Haman may be the first well-documented Jewish anti-Semite. Okay, let's talk briefly about one other Yuchsin issue that emerges potentially from at least one source we could point to Megillas Esther for a clarification on. As we know, a person has status as a Jew by virtue of being born to a Jewish mother. And in recent decades, determinations as to what's considered a Jewish mother have become more complicated with the advent, the proliferation of assisted reproductive technologies, of IVF, where the new realities of egg donors, of gestational carriers, of surrogates, potentially adds further wrinkles and complications to understanding or defining what is a mother. Does halacha recognize the genetic mother as the mother? Does halacha recognize the surrogate mother as a mother? What happens if one of these partners is Jewish and the other one is not? So one source that is pointed to in trying to get clarity in this matter. Is from the Psukim in Parshas Vayigash. We'll start there, and then we'll come to Megillas Esther. So in Parshas Vayigash, when the Torah lists the 70 descendants of Yaakov that come down to Mitzrayim, the Pasuk refers to one of the 70 as Shaul ben HaKenanis, Shaul the son of the Kenanis. Who is Shaul ben HaKenanis? So Rashi says, this is a Perek Memvav Pasuk Yud, Rashi says, Ben Dina. Shaul ben HaKenanis is Shaul ben Dina. Shenivel al HaKenani. That Dina was taken by Shechem. Kishahar Gwishchem, Lohaisa Dina wrote, Lohaisa Ashenishba Lashim and Shisena. Then Shimon promised that he would marry Dina. So one of the sons of Shimon listed in the Pasuk here is Shaul ben HaKenanis. So Shaul, according to this, was the son of Shimon and Dina. That asks the Moshe of Zakenim, one of the collections of the Bali Tosfos, on that Pasuk, Vitema, Heyach Nasa Shimon Asachoso. How could Shimon have married his sister Dina? A maternal sister is a prohibited relationship even for a Ben Noach, even before the Torah is given. So he has one answer that he rejects. And then he says, Yesh Lomar, She'ikar Herayon Shel Dina Bebetan Rachel Haya. That Dina was conceived in Rachel's uterus. And that's referenced in one of the piyutim. So this is a tradition that Chazal had, that Dina was initially conceived by Rachel, and that embryo was transplanted to Leah when Leah davened to Hashem that Rachel shouldn't have fewer boys towards the Shvatim than the other Shvachas, the Shivchas. So according to this tradition of Chazal, Dina was conceived by Rachel, was implanted to Leah. And according to that, it seems that the halakhic status or the Torah recognizes that the mother of Dina was in fact Rachel, not Leah, which is why, according to the halachas of Ben Noach, Dina was permitted to marry Shima. So some suggest that maybe this is evidence that the halachic mother is the genetic mother, since the genetic material here was Rachel's genetic material, even though Dina was carried by Leah, and that's why Dina was permitted to marry Shima. So some suggest that this may be relevant to determining the halachic position on maternity, that the genetic mother is the halachic mother. The counter argument to that is that this is a purely agadic statement, and it's hard to derive halachic norms from agadic statements. There's another indication that Rabbi Binyamin Karlbach, one of the Mir Rosh Yeshiva, quotes in his Sefer Chavetzelis HaSharon on Chumash, and that is a comment to the Maral on Megillas Esther. The Maral wrote a work called Or Chadash, which is a commentary on Megillas Esther. So he has the following comment. Vahi omenas hadasah hi Esther bas dodo, that Mordechai raised Hadassah, who was Esther. And the Pasuk says, ubemos avia v'ima, at the death of her mother and father, l'kachol lo l'Mordechai levas. Mordechai took her in as a daughter. So asks the Maral, what is this language of bemos avia v'ima? What does that add? It says Maral, Kaf Darash, Bemos Avia, Hainu, Bisha Shanasa La'av. So Bemos Aviha means at the time that the father became a father, that's when he died. Vahainu Ibarta Mesavia. At the time of conception, that's when the father died. That's the time that a father becomes a father, the time of conception, and that's when the father died. Ubishash and Asesla Ima, and the mother died at the time that she became a mother, Vizabisha Shanolda, and that's the time of birth. Tibishasa Ibor, Kavan Shalo Pire Shavlan Mimena, Lonikra Dainima, the time of conception, since the baby is still in utero for a while, that's not considered a definition of maternity. Mashenkein Eitzala Av, Shemiyajinis Abra Mimenu Nikravia. So a father's status is determined at the time of conception. A mother's status is determined at the time of birth. So that sounds like the halachic mother is the carrier and not the egg donor, not the contributor of the genetic material. And there are contrary indications in Gemaras as well, which we're not going to have the time to get into now. Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, according to Levrach, who passed away a couple months ago, our Avdezdin, he was of the opinion that he was strongly inclined in the position that the gestational or the surrogate mother is the halachic mother. And he quoted the following source that Rabbi Bleich quotes in the first volume of his Contemporary Halachic Problems as well. There is a sefer entitled HaTalmud U'Madai HaTevel, the Talmud and the Natural Sciences, written by Rabbi Yekusiel Aryeh Kamelhar in 1932. So he references here a medical convention that took place in Chicago, in which they discussed the potential of an ovarian transplant. So he raises the question as to what halacha would, how halacha would view such a procedure, well before it was ever done. So Rabbi Kelmahar quotes the following potential source as being relevant to this question. Gemara in Sot and Daf Mem Gimel Amud Beis discusses if you graft a seedling, if you graft a young plant onto a mature tree. And the question is, what is the orla status of this tree? The din is that you're not allowed to benefit from the fruits of a tree for the first 3 years of the tree's life. So if you have a sapling that you graft together with a mature tree and then it bears fruit, does it have the status of a sapling and then you'd have to wait a few years before you could use the fruit? Or does that have the status of a mature tree? So the Gemara there indicates that in the context of the sapling, when you graft a sapling onto a mature tree, it has the status of a mature tree. So Rabbi Kelmahar thinks that the same thing is true over here. If you were to transplant a rechem into a different mother, then the rechem is going to be batel to the new mother. And even if the genetic material comes from someone else. So that may indicate that the birth mother is the halachic mother. And Remeir Arik, one of the leading Galitzianer poskim before the war, has this idea as well. To which Rav Asher Weiss in Tshuva responded, V'chi ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, according to the pasuk in Shoftim, is man a tree? Meaning to say that very good in Hilchas Orla, that might be the case, that the seedling is batel to the tree. But what does that tell you? Why is that of any relevance to the question of defining maternity and whether the genetic material implanted into another woman would be batel to the second woman? So this is a matter of dispute among poskim. As we said, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Zichrono Livracha, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, Rav Zalman Nechemia, Goldberg, Zichrono Livracha, Rishlomo Zalman's son-in-law passed away recently as well, were inclined to the position that the gestational or surrogate mother is the halachic mother. And on the other side, Rav Avadia, Rav Yashiv, as was reported to be his position at the end of his life, and Lahavdil Ben Chaim L'Chaim, Rav Asher Weiss, Rabbi Willig, are of the opinion that the more likely the genetic mother is the halachic mother. That just as paternity is defined, determined by genetic material, so too would maternity be defined by genetic material. Nevertheless, since at the end of the day, this is a matter of dispute between poskim and there's no clear consensus, the practice of rabbinic courts, both here and in Eretz Yisrael, is that any time one of these partners, either the genetic mother or the gestational surrogate mother, are not Jewish, then a gerus would be in order to remove any potential doubt about the status of the progeny. And that is the recommendation, the practice of Batei Din, again, both here and in Eretz Yisrael, that under these circumstances, a gerus should be done. Just in the last 15 years or so that I've been involved in Beis Din matters, there's been a very noticeable change in the demographics of conversions done for minors. It used to be that the overwhelming majority of conversions done on minors were in situations of adoptions. And the numbers of adoptions anecdotally in the Frum community have gone down significantly in the last 10, 15 years as the instances of having children conceived through artificial reproductive means have gone up. And that has become a lot more common, popular, and efficient. So these days, the vast majority of conversion situations, minors that come to the Beis Din, are of, you do have cases of families converting together, but adoptions are way down, and these kinds of artificial reproductive conceptions are way up, and those are situations where the Beis Din gets involved. Okay, I think we're supposed to go for 40 minutes. It looks like we're out of time. There are more related issues to talk about maternity and some of the more complicated issues that have come up even more recently, that of mitochondrial DNA replacement, where there may be two potentially genetic mothers that contribute genetic material, and the question of some of the DNA research of determining potential of determining Jewishness on the basis of mitochondrial DNA evidence. So maybe we'll discuss that at a later session if time allows.
Okay. Wow, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Everyone should have a frail confirm. If anyone has any follow-up questions that they don't want to ask on the chat or live, I'll provide you with my email address here on the chat, and you can feel free to email me at your convenience if you ever want to follow up about everything. It's M. Zilberman, M-Z-Y-L-B-E-R-M-A-N at B-E-T-H-D-I-N.org, mzilberman@bethden.org. Feel free to follow up with any questions at any time if you want. Everyone should have a frail confirm. Stay safe.
Yeah, frail confirm.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pleasure.